Hi. We're with the singles today. That's terrific. In case you wonder if I think a person can minister effectively as a single, I don't know if you've asked me about that, but I certainly do. I have a sister who has never married and is quite a ministry, not just in recent days when she's begun to write, but prior to that in her Christian life. And so before you get hot and bothered with a lot of lather running all over you, wondering if I'm of the group that thinks you've got to be married to be effective, I really don't think that. Jesus did pretty good. And Paul didn't miss too many tricks either. And so I think there's no problem. I think some are called to be single. And you know who you are. It's sometime it occurs later in life, in the loss of a mate. And you realize God does not want you to marry again. We have a lady on our staff who has come to us as a widow. She lost her husband after a terrible bout with stomach cancer and a horrible death. And she grieved for 5-6 years through the death and has become extremely effective as our director of women's ministries. She's a single. We have another single lady on our staff. We have had single men on our staff, and currently our men are all married. But I just want to affirm you, if singleness is your state, and that's where God would have you, is currently leading you to remain, then I want to affirm that. This is our 19-year-old daughter who is a collegian in California, Colleen. And this is my 28-year-old wife on my left, Cynthia. And we're going to answer some questions. Do you have one you've looked at there you can start with, honey?
I think before we get started, as I'm reading some of these questions, I think it's impossible, really, to address some of these issues. Even perhaps decently, you know, with an answer that's going to suffice, but we'll give it a stab. This is one for single women who want marriage and children. We have a time clock within us if we want to have kids. We also seem to intimidate men with our knowledge, our aggressiveness. It seems that men want a submissive, obedient, feminine ideal for a wife rather than a ministry partner.
Hey.
That's just what I am, honey. One who will serve alongside. How can we get married? Well, I got married.
Thank you, Cynthia. That's very helpful.
I happen to have some single women on my staff at IFL that are a perfect description of individuals that are very talented, and it is true that a lot of men are intimidated by their capabilities. They're an average age of 30, and they've had a lot of professional experience, very, very with it. I don't know why that's true. I wish that men were more men. And I think that Dallas Seminary is a great place where probably that is not as true as in other parts of our country. I hope that it's not true. But I think the advice that I've really learned from my sister-in-law, Lucy, is whatever state you're in, therein be content and be very aggressively pursuing life. And don't just wait for that magic day when Mr. Wright will come along and marriage does take place, because it may never take place, but you can have a very, very satisfying and fulfilling life without that, if that is God's plan for you. And that is about the most I think I could say for this kind of a state without dealing with it personally.
How much of your ministry experiences, especially the struggles, do you share with Cynthia? I have been exposed to a teaching that says the minister is to, quote, protect his wife from all the struggles and pressures he faces. Let me answer this one very honestly with you. There was a time in my life where just about every single uncomfortable, unhappy struggle and experience I was going through, I shared with her. I mean, without reservation. And the result was a bit of a misunderstanding of ministry, because all she got was the bad news. I wasn't as faithful to share with her the good things and the happy experiences and the fine responses. So in giving you that slice of our life, let me add this today. If there is a sin, what I do share is the area of major struggles that I'm going through. I don't keep a commentary through the day of every ornery comment or every off-color look I get, something like that. That's pretty petty. But if there's something that's troubling me, by the end of the day, she will know about it. If it's big enough to disturb me, then she will want to know about it, because our relationship is such that she will read discomfort in me. So the openness we have is not a rehearsing of all the bad news that's happened every day, but if it has been the kind of thing that's disturbed us by the end of the day, we are pretty likely to share it. Colleen has an interesting one here.
Okay. This is how to keep a balance of having a girlfriend in another state.
No, not that one. The other
I'm
one.
Not reading the other one.
Colleen, read that other one. This is great. God has told me to marry your daughter, Colleen. Can we talk after chapel? That's why you came to Dallas, and you told me.
I'll have to add. They'll have to be very creative, and they'll have to have on roller skates.
Okay, go ahead with the serious stuff.
Okay. About keeping a balance between if you have a girlfriend or boyfriend in another state, a couple years ago I was involved in a relationship that he was further away, and what you have to do is direct your time, because it can't be spent together. Put that time into other ways of communicating with that person, whether it's on the phone or through letters, because you can find out so much about how a person thinks and different things, how they would react to situations. I think just through hearing their thoughts on the papers as you read through things, or hear them talking on the telephone, and you can find out just a lot about a person spending time with them through these other ways. Relationships take 100% of your time, and if you want to make it work, it can work, but it takes a lot of that. And I think when they're far away, it takes even 110%, because they're not always going to be there. But also, you don't have that. In relationships, there's kind of a sense of security, and that person is right there, and it's neat and fun and all that. As where when they're far away, you are able to develop yourself and give to that person when they're far away, and you still, do you know what I'm saying? You still kind of keep that balance, and you're still a stable person. You can't rely on the other person, and therefore, sometimes it's easier when they're far away to have that relationship built on Christ and have that as a solid foundation. And then when they're there, it can be even stronger.
It also helps when mother and daddy pay the telephone bills.
Yes, it does. Someone sent this to us about the time spent in engagement. I'm trying to find it. I've thought seriously about the commitment of engagement, but feel like I have to put in a certain amount of time in the relationship first for two reasons. One, to get to know each other well enough. And two, so that someday our kids wouldn't come to us and say they wanted to get married after dating only a few months, as we had decided upon. The Swindolls dated for 6 days, and on the seventh...
they were engaged.
No, I know. It says that. It says. And instead of resting, they got engaged. This guy's getting biblical about the process, isn't he? Is engagement not a total commitment? Is engagement a total commitment? I think marriage is a total commitment, but to say, I mean, you're saying total commitment, that means it's irreversible to me. If it's total, then I would say no, I don't believe it's irreversible. Our situation, we've told kids this, very different. We were very mature. And no, you may not answer. This person says, we love each other and we are committed. What do I think about his concern? I think you're wise. I think we were hasty. I think that the 18 months of courtship that followed was essential for us, though we were terribly young, much too young to have done something like that. But it's remarkable, I've got to tell you, I have never once, God's my witness on this, looked back and wished otherwise. It so happens in our case that it worked. I've seen people who've gone together 2-3 years and were engaged, went together another year and were married, and their marriage didn't last. So that's the other side. I don't know how much stock we can place in length of time that's involved in the courtship. Each individual case seems to stand on its own. We needed the 18 months. We needed probably more than that, coming from the homes we came from. But our situations were not desperate as much as they were most unhappy, and we knew we would be more fulfilled and effective together than we ever could have been separate. And that has been true. I hope that's a fair answer.
What advice would you give to a person considering interracial marriage? I smile when I look at this question, because this is a question that Chuck and I have in years past really talked about, because we faced that somewhat on the West Coast before maybe it was faced as much here in Texas and on the East Coast. To my knowledge, I don't believe anyone has approached Chuck before getting married with a request that he marry them, so that he hasn't had opportunity to go through all of those issues. But we have several interracial marriages in our church, and they have children, and they're obviously very happy. Many of them are involved in leadership. As far as I personally am concerned, I think that they do face some challenges that other marriages do not face. And you have to ask, is this indeed God's will for us? And is the ministry that God has for us going to be enhanced and much more significant as a result of our marriage together? Because that is indeed why you should get married, or one of the reasons. So that if you can answer those questions affirmatively and hopefully with the consent of both sets of parents on each side, I think that it can be a beautiful ministry and a beautiful marriage. But you do have to face the challenges of what's going to happen with the children, and that's some of the challenges that the parents in our congregation are having to face. As their children grow up, in our cases, it's primarily black with white. Who will they date? And in fact, one of our dear friends' son married a black gal, and she has been the very best thing in the world for him. They had prayed and prayed that God would turn his life around, because he was in his late 20s. He was not strongly rebellious against the Lord, but he just had no interest in spiritual things at all. And May came into his life and totally, totally changed it. And she is a marvelous woman and a marvelous mother. So we've seen it work very, very constructively.
There's another dimension of that, and that is the in-laws. Often the husband-wife team, very close together, very much committed to one another, and they've solved some of those struggles, or all of those struggles. But mom and dad have not. And there is a case that with Jim Christensen, remember, in their marriage, where the in-laws had such terrific struggles with that on the gal's side, and has not yet been reconciled. So that's another part of the interracial thing that has to be faced.
Well, Jim was not black; he was Samoyed, and Samoan, and that was just a struggle for her parents.
For one who devotes to full-time ministry, does his mate have to have the same lifetime goal, or just willingness to go along? You know, that's a tough one for me to answer, because I have never faced that. I have talked with people who have faced that problem. I have never gone to a ministry for a period of time that is a permanent change to a ministry where Cynthia was not in agreement. I haven't said, honey, just grit your teeth and bear it. God's leading me there. Somehow that doesn't seem to wash if we are really one together. I am, in my opinion here, I am to wait on the Lord. I am to pray. I am to count on God to change her feelings if it is in fact His will for me to do that. If her feelings do not change, I respect her resistance too much to plow right on. I have dealt with some folks who have gone on where one wasn't in favor of it, and the ramifications became very complex, very severe. The ministry was hindered and hurt. So without casting blame on one side or the other, I just would say that there, ideally you would want to have someone who would have this lifetime goal with you for ministry. Or find a kind of ministry where that mate would be comfortable. Often that resistance reflects other things deeper than just going to some other place to serve Christ. Sometimes it's a resistance that's not related to geography. It may be related to what it would be the expectations of the person there, and that would have to be addressed.
I've been through the breakup of 1 year engagement relationship and the breakup of an actual engagement. I deeply desire to make a lifelong commitment to a mate, but I find myself paralyzed by fear of again making the wrong commitment. Divorce stats aren't too encouraging either. How does one overcome such fear?
These are easy, aren't they, honey? Aren't they?
I have a strong belief in the sovereignty of God, and I would assume, if I were in this situation, that the breakups were God-ordained, and be very grateful and very thankful for it, but not let that hinder the pursuit of finding a mate, if that was indeed what I felt God wanted me to do. And for me, I think that just my knowledge of His sovereignty would be sufficient enough to help me to overcome the fear. And I would suggest that. I don't really have another answer for that.
Let me suggest a couple of books that I've found helpful. One is called Soloing. Another one is a book that my sister wrote called Wide My World, Narrow My Bed, by Lucy Swindoll. She, in it, talks about some of the struggles related to her life as a single woman, and as it relates to ministry as well. The part of it that helped me as a married person was the part where she talked about a number of the benefits there are in the single life, and how she has really made the best out of them. And when you read it, you almost look upon it with a yearning, like that is really where there is fulfillment and delight. And she certainly is a model of it. Someone asked, could you please address the issue of professional women as mothers, homemakers? Do scriptures clearly indicate the answer? Why aren't more women older? She means, why aren't more older women teaching the younger women? You know, that is a very good question, that last question. I'll start there and work back up. I don't know why more aren't. Maybe because they're not given permission. Maybe there isn't a program provided in most ministries for the older person. And the tendency on the part of the older one is just by nature to take a place on a shelf to get out of the way while life moves on. We have seen the effectiveness in our ministry in Fullerton of older women teaching our younger women, but we've had to set up the arrangement and we've had to kind of implement the process so that there was an openness and a willingness to do that. The older person has to be carefully chosen. Not all older people are qualified, at least in my opinion, to teach people. You've got to pick them carefully, just like all are not qualified to serve in some gifted capacity. And so we've tried to match those situations, and it's worked rather well, as a matter of fact. You got one there? You wanted me to go back to this one? You want to address the issue of professional women, since you are one and also a mother and a homemaker? Would you please quote the scriptures, too, that you have for that? Clearly indicate the answer.
I really feel that sometimes some teachers of Scripture have structured, according to their own biases and their own bents, exactly what the role of a woman is and how she is to perform as a mother and as a homemaker, to the exclusion of the fact that I feel God is very, very creative and that He put a lot of creativity within us. And I happen to also believe strongly that God very definitely, in my own instance, led me into the career that I am in. And if I were in disobedience to Him because of my extreme love for Him and my commitment to Him, I am also very positive that that would have been communicated to me. So I feel we need to balance the two. Our primary relationship responsibility while the children are in the home is to them and to our husband, but we can also have a career. And it doesn't mean that a woman has to do everything. I don't have to do all of the sewing, and I don't have to do all of the cooking, and I didn't have to teach my girls how to cook. There are cooking classes that they can take. My 16-year-old son can wash his own clothes. He can do his own ironing.
It looks scary, but he can do it. It's a funny looking.
We share in the responsibilities. And I feel that the roles can be carried out in a variety of ways suited to your husband and to your family's needs.
Let me step in here and say, I'd encourage you to take a look at Proverbs 31. Study the woman in Proverbs 31. Do your very best, and I know it's difficult to do this, do your very best to hold your bias back and let the scriptures speak. I think you will find a woman who was extremely efficient and very much involved in a world, including her home, but outside the home as well. And yet she is a woman who is called a virtuous and excellent, one who controls herself with strength and dignity, very secure. I would love to have met the man in that woman's life, the husband, the father of those children. I would like to see him portrayed as well. Because this kind of woman that we're trying to picture here, and I know that you want to emulate, is a woman who, if she does marry, must have a husband who is secure enough to provide that kind of freedom. Many men are easily threatened by very efficient, capable women. Many men who are that threatened don't quite know how to handle themselves or what to do when they're around a woman who can do the kind of thing he does, not just as well, but some of it better. And he, in his frustration, dives into the scripture to find the place to set her straight. I hope that isn't unfair, but I have seen that occur. Now, woman, the answer is not for you to become bitter and surly any more than it is the answer for the man to become a wimp and to deny his role as a masculine person and as a leader. But it takes some negotiation. There are tensions in what we have been talking about that time doesn't provide us to get into, but I can assure you we have had to work through them, and we still do. But I found that a lot of my convictions had been tempered and shaped by the way I was reared, not by the scriptures, by the traditionalism of my past, not by God. And having said all of that, I don't take back one thing I've said about rearing families, about marriage and the importance of the home and the role of the leader in the home. But I am so pleased to be in an era where women have places of dignity and significance. And it's a beautiful thing to see them fill those places efficiently without the least bit of concern of taking charge or running wild with their role. And I am seeing that. And I love seeing that. I hope that's a fair treatment of that issue, because it is it's a tough one today.
Is it?
Are we through? 20 after? Okay.
Do you have one?
What can you say to the single woman contemplating marriage to a man who cannot have children and does not wish to adopt? She, underline, really desires children, and they are both approaching their 40s. It sounds to me like you're heading for a real conflict. I don't think that takes the wisdom of Solomon to figure that out. If you really want children and you're contemplating marriage to a man who really does not want to have children and does not want to adopt, I would be very, very careful about continuing that relationship until you get that one solved. There's going to have to be some compromise on one part or the other, especially when you add you really desire children and both of you are approaching your 40s. Unless your names are Abraham and Sarah, and God's going to do something miraculous, I think you're heading for a major conflict. I'm sure there's more to the relationship than this issue, but that's a major factor. Time would be of the essence as well in this. You know, this is our last brown bag with you folks at the seminary, and I haven't taken the time because my time has always been so limited over at the chapel and then over at the church, and then here we've tried to get right into it. But I want to tell you that Cynthia and I, Colleen hasn't been on the campus before, but Cynthia and I are thrilled to see some wonderful changes occurring. I am very encouraged. I am encouraged by the spirit around here. There is a more of an openness than I have seen before. There is a opportunity for response. In my era, in our era, Bill, you came, sat, listened, and left. Hopefully you absorbed as much as you could, but there weren't many times given for response or for interaction. All those who came as guests came behind pulpits, lectured, and left. You took tests, and you passed them, or hopefully, and then you went to the next year. So all of these figures kind of came like 10 soldiers. But I'm sensing on the campus an openness and an interaction with things that are occurring, and that is very refreshing. So we are pleased to see that. We're also thrilled to see that the students seem to have, you students seem to have a better grip on the issues that are occurring in life. You're not just here as theoretical minds filling yourself with facts to go out to dump those facts on congregations. Because the one great culture shock you will experience in ministry is that when you get out from this place, nobody is a seminary graduate. They're all just human beings with real human needs, and they want you to be their friend. They want you to be their shepherd. They want you to be real, authentic human beings. They will love you for your model and all that, but I think I'm seeing some of that occurring, Bill, in the school. And as a board member, as an alumnus, as one with you in ministry, I am very encouraged. I am very pleased to have had a small part in this transition, and that's great. Would it be appropriate for us to close these sessions with a time of prayer? Let me lead us. Why don't you bow with me? Lord, how grateful we are to have had some time with the students and to have seen their faces and read some of their questions, interacted with some of their concerns. Thank you for the work you are doing. Really, this is the result of much prayer. This kind of change comes by prayer and fasting. There are people who have faithfully upheld us. Some in our own church at home, some in this place, in this student body, the faculty, the administration, and the mates of those people. We thank you for being in this place of service, for the privilege of learning at your feet. Thank you for giving certain people a certain style of ministry that fits with where we are, that we can identify with, that we can understand. That brings encouragement. Thank you for the effort that has gone into making this week possible. I want to pray for Dennis and Barb Rainey also and their time here tomorrow in this very place and for the weekend that they will graciously provide. I pray that the practical projects, the time, the effort, the attention given by that couple will result in stronger lives, deeper commitments, and for the ones who are married, for marriages that are healthier and happier. Thank you in advance for the deeper commitments that have come as a result of the time we have spent. May the balance of this day and tomorrow and the weekend bring glory to your name and honor to the ministry of Jesus Christ, in whose name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your gracious hospitality with us.